Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I am Adam Lowther, along with Chris Stewart and Jim Petrosky. And hey, Jim, how are you?
I'm doing well. It's been a while since I've been on this show.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a busy few weeks. You and I were at the HEART Conference, the Hardened Electronics and Radiological Technologies Conference last week in beautiful Huntsville, Alabama. It was a great time to be there. The weather was, you know, 70s, maybe low 80s, so the weather was good. And lots of good research was discussed and, you know, talked to a lot of great folks. And, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who are working on the very concerns that, you know, we have in terms of making sure our electronics and systems are hardened against EMP and some other things that we talked about. So it was and we got to go to MDA, the Missile Defense Agency, and see, it's a nice campus they've got. We met with some of their senior leadership. So it was a good opportunity.
Yeah. But and now I'd we're say back. It was great to sit with you and Curtis face to face, but also the HEART Conference to me is like going to a family reunion once a year. So I love doing it. And I just want to do a shout out to all my science and technology friends that I got a chance to sit down and have breakfast, lunch, and dinner with out there. So, and with our topic today, all that science and technology feeds right into what we're going to talk about, Adam.
Hey, yeah. Wait. Before we go on, give us the end of the story. So are we prepared for an EMP? Have we made progress in hardening our critical infrastructure, et cetera?
So are we ready? Ready is an interesting question here, Chris. Thanks for the setup off the cuff. But the answer is there's a lot of study that's going on, especially not critical infrastructure. We were looking at U.S. infrastructure. We were really looking at military systems to be able to survive nuclear weapon effects, primarily space and ground and military systems themselves. There's a lot of testing and evaluation going on throughout the United States. I will say, you know, items like in space with system-generated EMP, distributed EMP, these are topics that we cover in the NIDS knowledge. But those topics that have not been studied because we've never really done a test of those are being tested on the ground and understood much better and are being entwined into our military systems, which I think is important from a deterrence standpoint. It says we're less vulnerable to some things than we were before. Now, critical infrastructure in the U.S., we really didn't cover that topic in this conference. And it is a good topic of discussion that I think is needed.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Well, that you know that's part of the division, right? I mean, so for most of the folks at HEART, they're focused on, you know, military systems, whereas that critical infrastructure stuff is just sort of outside the bounds of what, you know, what those folks look at because of how we divide up, you know, protecting assets. So it's maybe that's one of those things we should think more about is how do we, you know, bridge the gap there?
Yeah.
So for this week, we were going to talk about, we've had some news over the past few months, and we've talked about it individually. We've talked about Sentinel and the problems in the Sentinel program. There was, in March, there was an announcement that funding for LRSO, the long-range strike, the cruise missile, there was some cuts to that. And the funny thing with LRSO is LRSO was on time and under budget. So it was sort of our best program. And there were, you know, there's some cuts there, delays that'll slow the production of LRSO. And then, of course, we found out here recently that Columbia, the submarine, is having some challenges. Particularly with the nose section that are going to, it's a supplier issue. This is one of these big problems that we've seen since the beginning of COVID, where we've had labor issues. Unemployment is quite low, but the labor participation rate is also lower than ever. So there are fewer people as a percentage of the population working, even though everybody seems to have jobs. There's just a lot less people working. And, so that's creating problems and supply problems that have persisted since COVID. And then we just found out there's an article out today that was a discussion of B-21, in which the chief of staff of the Air Force, General Alvin, said that there would be no planned additional production of B-21, because there's been a significant call for increasing the number of B-21s produced, which is, if you look at bomber operations, it makes perfect sense to do so. But General Alvin said that, well, by the mid-30s, there may be technologies that make the B-21 either obsolete or suboptimal in terms of performing the mission, which is, that's sort of an eye-opener. So we've got some, I wouldn't say that modernization has gone off the rails, but, and of course we've got problems with pit production. We can't produce the 80 pits a year we need. Building, PF4 is sort of slow. We've had all sorts of challenges. And so I thought the discussion today should be about this inability, broadly speaking, to produce a modernization program, an unprecedented modernization program on time. We can't do it on budget. That's one of the big Sentinel challenges. We found that with the infrastructure problems that we're having with Sentinel, replacing the silos and all that. And so I thought Chris, former congressman, Jim, nuclear engineer, I figured you guys would know a lot about issues in terms of delays, funding cuts, all sorts of stuff of that. So let me go to you first, Chris, and let's talk about the congressional angle on this and sort of some of the challenges that are, in there in terms of whether it's funding or other requirements to meet congressional deadlines. So talk to me about that.
Well, I think broadly through Congress, there's a lot of frustration with the acquisition process, and there's deep, deep frustration, even anger, at programs that come in way over budget and way behind schedule, and we continue to reward or at least to incentivize in a perverse way, actually, the prime contractors. I mean, they just pay no economic cost for these dry outs. And I mean, to say that Congress is frustrated with that, I mean, that's an understatement, and it's hardly shocking, right? None of you are going to be surprised by that. But for the first time in my experience in Congress, or having recently retired, still having, deep conversations there, you really have people advocating saying, hey, let's cancel the program. And you never had serious conversations about this. And this isn't the Mavericks. These aren't guys, who want to cut defense. These aren't peaceniks who, don't want to spend any money on defense. These are serious defense hawks. These are chairmen of subcommittees. These are people who work in the, supporting the defense industry, supporting our Pentagon. And they're just frankly, they're just really ticked off about it, and they're tired of it. And it's billions and billions of dollars. And, we could go through the different programs, and we probably, I know you guys have talked about some of it recently, but I mean, the Sentinel program's a year behind when it's a year into the program. And it's, tens and tens of billions of dollars over budget when it's a year into a 10 or 12 year program. And we talk about the B-21, it's on target, which is good. It's under budget or slightly at or just right at budget, which is obviously great. But let's think about how long we gave that program. I mean, we awarded that contract in 2015, and we're going to be buying the airplanes until 2040 or until 2039. I mean, that's That's a long, long time. And that's after a contract award. That's after all the initial research and development and the competition process. And so it's not comforting, but it's also not surprising to say, well, to have some of the, you know, senior leadership at the Pentagon say, well, we may not be buying any more of them. In fact, they may advocate for cutting the number of 100 because it's taking so long to purchase them that by the time we are halfway through the cycle, they may be outdated at that point. And so again, good news is they're not delayed, they're not over budget, but the bad news is the contract just was excruciatingly long in the first place. To give us 25 years from award contract to where we purchased last airplane in a very dynamic environment. Oh my gosh, can you imagine trying to use a computer that was designed 25 years ago? And these weapon systems are essentially flying computers. I mean, there's everything about them is deeply, deeply technical. And, you know, it's frustrating. I'll just say, you know, Adam, you asked me what Congress's feelings on this are. People are angry and they really, really want to see if we can make some changes in this.
Well, let me,
since Chris jumped me on a question, Adam, I've got to get jumped on back at Chris now, just, yeah. You know, to make it even. So you say they're angry and they're ticked off. To whom are they ticked off and angry about? Because, you know, these processes and the responsibilities that we have for feeding back and developing programs and having them monitored and having them reported and going through all the paperwork within government, you know, all that stuff is just a burden on the organizations trying to do this. So I'm curious when you say they're ticked off, who's ticked off at whom and where does the problem lie? And I like poking at the problem because I think it's bigger than this. This is just a result of other things that are happening. So I'll let you answer that, Chris.
Well, I mean, if you want to know who they're ticked off at, they're kind of like the old guy who's standing out in the lawn, you know, yelling at clouds in the sky. I mean, who's he angry at, right? It's kind of hard to define. And what they say is, well, we're angry at the acquisition process, or we're angry at the contractors, or, you know, the decision makers. I mean, it's all of it and it's none of it. And as long as it's all of it, then it is none of it. If there's not one organization or one person who's responsible, then no one is responsible, to say a cliche that is, you know, painfully true and painfully clear in this case. The three of us could talk for ad nauseum. We could talk for weeks about defaults in the acquisition process. The good news is Congress is likely to demand a study. And once they have the study, then, you know, everything's going to be fixed. So,
Well, it's funny that you say that because a few years ago, I actually did an acquisition reform study. And what we found when we went out to do this study was within the last 5 years, there had been 175 acquisition reform studies. Yeah. We know what's wrong with the system. We know how to fix it, but we never get it fixed. And I guess part of my problem is, you know, take the Darlene Drurian affair that everybody knows about, you know, where she directed some work to Boeing and then Boeing hired her when she left government. And, you know, it was ethical violations and all. But for what was essentially sort of $1 million worth of misconduct, Congress passed new regulations that made the process much longer and much more expensive. And so I wonder if sometimes the cure is worse than the disease, sort of like COVID. You know, is the cure worse than the disease? And has Congress, do they bear some of the responsibility for creating a system that, you know, is so rigorous on making sure nobody cheats the government out of a nickel that it costs, you know, to save a nickel, you spend $10.
Yeah.
And because I wonder how much of that is part of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the problem, there's no doubt. And it's probably a significant part of the problem. I don't think it's the majority, but it's, you know, it's certainly one of the things. And I don't disagree with you. And by the way, I wouldn't defend Congress on this issue. In fact, there's very little that I would defend Congress about on nearly any issue. But there really is a propensity in Congress to, and we were you know, kind of talking sarcastically about demanding a study, but it's really true. I mean, and thereby by doing that, Congress feels like they did something, right? But no one ever implements the results of those studies. And your thing about 170 of them, you know, that's absolutely true. And that's true of almost every problem that we have. There are, again, some perverse incentives that Congress allows, in fact, probably facilitates in these contracts. The fact that Congress can't appropriate money year to year, right? That we go into these CRs and potential government shutdowns, which have just enormous impacts on DOD. There's no organization in the government that it impacts as adversely as it does contracting in DOD. And it certainly drives up the costs and certainly drives up delays. So, you know, Congress is complicit in this. And part of the complicity is frankly, them just not demanding more change, but also cleaning up their own house. So, I mean, look, I don't want to sound cynical on this, but to be honest with you, I am a little bit cynical. The problem is so enormous and so long term that I just don't know that there is the political will to change it. And the last thing I'll say on that is this. The days of really innovative, creative, you know, really giving leaders the authority to go innovate and to do it very quickly, it's very, very hard to do that in any bureaucracy, which the Pentagon is. And I think it's particularly hard in the Pentagon for a number of reasons. Adam, one of them is what you just said. There's legislation that kind of ties their hands. And honestly, we don't reward innovation or creative thinking at senior levels. In fact, we completely disincentivize it.
Risk aversion.
A lot of things we could talk about regarding this. Bottom line, though, and I know I've talked a while, I'm gonna be quiet here and let, you know, people who are smarter than me, like Dr. Petrosky, talk. But I mean, look at the programs. Sentinel, a year into it, a year behind, tens of billions of dollars over budget. Look at the B-21. Yeah, technically not over time, but the contract was. Gives them way too much time to innovate and to build those things. And again, that's part of Congress because we don't fund but 6 or 7 airplanes a year to go purchase them. Columbia, I mean, the list is long, and it's particularly critical in nuclear deterrence because, again, we leave ourselves with gaps that are just far more important than saying not being able to get, you know, new laptops for our secretaries. That's just not quite as critical as these very important deterrent weapon systems like we're talking about.
So let me ask you, Jim, then. So for like Sentinel's kind of a good example where part of the challenge is, you know, the cost overruns were largely a result not of, you know, Northrop is on time and target with the actual missile. But the cost overruns were in the projections for what it would cost to essentially, you know, refit the silos with all the new tech that's got to go in and putting in new cables and, you know, all of that sort of infrastructure work. That's where the Air Force really sort of got the number wrong. And so I wonder if from the sort of the engineering side, is the fact that we do these, you know, once every 50 years, right? Those silos were built in the 60s and they have largely been left for the most part alone. And so I wonder when you only do something once every 50 years, I've wondered, like, how do you effectively create an acquisition cost estimating that's in any way for a big project like that? How do you do that accurately when you do it like once every 50 years? How would engineers say, well, we're going to need 17 of these widgets and that's it? So help me understand from a technical perspective these challenges.
Okay, thanks, Adam. Yeah, so first of all, logistics and are not my forte, but let me first start with a comment Chris made. And again, Chris, if the audience was able to see my screen the way it is, it's probably unfair because I see Adam's face, I see my face, and then underneath it, I see you, and we're just crushing on you in terms of beating on you. So we're not doing this deliberately, but I am having fun with it. So
you know I'm sensitive, though. You got to treat me gently.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So first of all, you said about innovation, but I will say you're right about the issue of innovation from the leadership standpoint. And especially the national level leadership. I'm going to go back to our earlier comments. And Adam, I'm going to answer your question. But you talk about innovation. I just spent a week at a conference where almost every organization there was extremely innovative in understanding the problem that we're solving, which Rad-Hard Electronics in space on missile systems that have to work every time, all the time. Oh, and for the weapons, you don't even get to really test them fully. You have to find a way to test them completely without the environment you have and completely without all the components at the same time and completely without all the technology at one time for something that's going to be fielded later on. And they're doing it very well. It's an impressive amount of innovation because companies stand up and they move forward. We saw that in the Manhattan Project. We've seen that previously in modernization. So I think the innovation can be done. I think the problem falls out, and again, Adam, I'm not going to forget you, the two places where I think it hits. And one is in education and workforce. You've got to have a workforce that is capable of applying themselves in the technical skills. This is what Adam said about the Air Force, the baseline technical skills, laying concrete, putting in wire, manufacturing, equipping, developing, traveling components, traveling with components and, being safe and secure. All of those things have to happen for these things to happen. So as an engineer, you're biting off this, you're looking at this elephant and all the components of it, and they're all different. So we need a workforce that's capable of doing that in a trusted, reliable fashion, and we've lost some of that. I think it's gainable. I'm not gonna cast dispersions upon the against the current group of people that are going through colleges, but we've got to focus that. And when I talk to people in universities, there is no focus toward this kind of work, the kind of work that we need, and I don't think anyone's connecting them. So that's one thing that I think is really important. And in fact, I talked to a few people when I was at the conference. Said, if you could go back 20 years, what would you do? Oh, I'd invest in people that are working then. Well, what are you going to do 20 years from now if you're not investing in them now? I mean, someone's got to prepare the next generation. And I see that the leadership who's responsible for taking the risk, not voting risk, moving risk, et cetera, they've got to take that risk now for what the future holds. And we have that. I just don't see that foresight. Then in the logistics side. So first of all, people. People make things work. The layman, the driver, the radio operator, all those people have to work there, all the way up to the fundamental scientists and those people doing those highly technical jobs. But then the other piece is the logistics that Adam said. And you're right, Adam. These are big projects, but there are fundamental requirements when you're doing any logistical project that are standard practice. And I see from my angle, when I look at standard practice of how organizations must work, you have to work with standard practices that are reliable and projectable. You got to be able to project what the next step is. And the way that our country continues to evolve the language of logistics, the language, and when I say this from the congressional side, from the requirements side, the requirements keep changing. We keep fixing things, but as Adam said, the solution is probably harder to solve than the problem itself. What'd you say? The disease, the cure is worse than the disease.
Right.
And as we continue to do that, businesses can't project out 10 years when they don't know next year. I mean, right now, let's look at our country and be honest. What is the business environment going to be next year, and how do you invest in that? I'll travel that back to our workforce. Our workforce 20 years ago could not have imagined the workforce that it is today, but it is today's workforce. We've got to take and have the fortitude to say, this is what we need. We've had tried and true practices after World War II, during the Cold War. We knew things that worked, and we walked away from them. We've got to walk back. And walking back doesn't sound like a real adventurous thing, but imagine walking back, but with the technology we have. Can you imagine in 1953, if we had the technology we have today in 1953, when we were out building systems on the ground, how many missile silos, I wish Curtis was here, how many missile silos a year they were putting in the ground? Imagine where we'd be now if we had that technology. Well, we have that technology. We just need the will to put it to use. And that is all based on human ingenuity and common practices and skills that we need developed. So two things. I'm not going to be a three-person thing. Two things, workforce and logistics. And then and get the heck out of the way. I almost said it. And then we're good to go.
It does seem like, so I'll just, you know, we often reason by analogies and personal experience. And you, so I have, you know, I have a son who's in the engineering program at Maple Woods College. And we were talking to his advisor. And the advisor said that the engineering program, because we were trying to pick classes, you know, he's trying to get classes. And the advisor said, well, we historically have had 300 students in that program. We're now down to 60 because people are just not, they're not going into engineering. And then, you know, I have an affiliation with Kansas State and the mechanical and nuclear engineering department. And we were talking about that program, and their enrollments have declined quite a bit. And, you know, they're one of the few schools that has a nuclear reactor. And so I guess part of my question here is we think about workforce is just this idea that kids, and if you really think about like in the engineering and other hard sciences, a lot of your students are foreign nationals who've come to the U.S. because we have really good engineering programs. And then when we want to go put people in national security jobs, you tend to need, you know, American-born folks. And so that makes it doubly difficult because the enrollments are declining. A lot of your students are foreign-born. So it makes it really hard. And then on top of it, if you, let's say, move out of the engineering degrees and you look at skilled trades, you know, the Navy, in order to build the Columbia, they, you know, there's a website, you know, buildsubmarines.com, because they're trying to find welders and pipe fitters and all those skilled trades, and they're struggling there. And so I just wonder what it is about, maybe it's American culture, values, I don't know what, that is leading Americans to want to, you know, be on a contestant on The Bachelor or a social influencer or whatever, as opposed to an engineer or, you know, some other skilled trade, which we were so good at. I mean, we won World War II by building stuff.
And those people were available, you know, the physicists, et cetera, that were available to invent radar, to do cryptography, to build the nuclear weapons themselves and all the background work in all of those three subjects that came out in World War II. But this is where I'll point back to Chris, because I picked on him earlier, but I'm going to pick again. We, you know, there has to be some foresight in incentivizing people to go into these areas, not just handing out dollars to say, go to college, because go to college may not be the answer. Become an engineer, build a skill, build a trade skill. And we can incentivize that. We're spending billions of dollars on education, but we need to, you know, seriously focus it on the needs of the nation. And that will incentivize, or at least partly incentivize people. Money talks. We all know that, and that's what works. And once you get your foot in the ground, and, you know, I did the same. I became an engineer, you know, when I started college. I didn't intend on doing it in high school, but I saw a talk by a friend who is a military engineer who said, I've built a career of this, and this really worked well. And that's what started me down that road. And it was really it was really paid off in the end. And so we need to find ways to incentivize the skills we need, not just any skills. And I know universities are going to kick back on that. They don't like that. I get it, because they've lost programs over this. They can also gain programs if they are innovative in the way they approach it.
Yeah. So, you know, it's an interesting conversation, and it's a little bit different than when we started out with, you know, delays in these programs. But it really is one of the things we have to deal with. And I'd maybe add just two thoughts if I could. Number one, Adam, you know, your conversation about a program that used to have 200 and now has 60. And we should remember that's despite the fact that for the last 8 years or so, we have really pushed STEM education. We've really pushed the importance of STEM education in you know, even in the middle schools, and tried to prepare high school kids for that. And I guess we've had mixed results on that, but I think we can say pretty confidently, if we wouldn't have pushed that, it probably would have been worse. So it's, you know, I hate to imagine what it would have been, and clearly it's still a concern. And then, you know, James, to something that you said about, well, both of you mentioned this, I think sometimes we convey to young people, and I feel really strongly about this, we sometimes convey to young people that if they don't go to college, they failed somehow. And it's just not true. I mean, if you're an electrician, if you're a pipe fitter, like we need on these programs, you know, we need welders, we need, you know, skilled craftsmen.
Preach it, Chris.
People who can work. I'm sorry?
Preach it, Chris.
Preach it. Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you can work with composites, and you know what? You don't need a college degree to do that. And they're great careers, and people can make a good living. And I use my family's example. I have some sons that are doctors and lawyers, and I have a son-in-law who's an electrician. And I tell him all the time, dude, I'm so proud of you. I'm proud of what you do. And look, at the end of the day, you can say, I helped build this building, or I helped build this house, and he's a great provider. And again, for some kids, going into the trades is such an honorable profession. And not only did they not fail because they didn't go to college, but they're succeeding in very important ways. And the industrial base that we need to defend our nation is dependent on those kinds of men and women. And we should never, ever denigrate or imply that what they do doesn't matter, because they are the foundation. Without them, you can't build a doorknob. Without, you know, crafts and skilled craftsmen who you know, take pride in their professions.
Even better, they'll never be replaced by AI. There will never be an AI plumber or an AI welder or an AI pipe fitter. Yeah. They're going to always have jobs, and they're always going to have respectable careers. And, you know, I know we're out of time, but Jim, I wanted to give you, so for each of you, very quickly, 30 seconds, as we look at the slippages, the delays, the budget challenges, if you had one or two sort of quick solutions, what are they? Jim, you go first.
All right. Thanks, Adam. Yeah, so we did get off track a little bit. So here's my only comment that doesn't fit on the track that we followed. And that is, when you're eliminating programs, what you've got to do is you've got to go back, or at least eliminating or downscaling. You got to ask, what was the need to develop that program in the first place? And does that need still exist? And are we still going to meet it? Because otherwise, we're just wasting time and money. We should always be getting what we need, no matter what our adversary's dynamics. So we got to change with the adversary. And number two, weigh out that consequence. And I didn't see that in any of these articles. Like, let's just cut these things. Well, they're not just things. They are valuable instruments of war that also keep us at peace.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in 30 seconds, I'll just say, I would start with my own house, and that's Congress. And Congress has got to do better. And I'd say in two things. Number one is, they need to pass appropriations bills. They need to eliminate the uncertainty that contractors and the DOD can go forward with contracts, especially when it comes to acquisitions. And the second thing is, I think Congress can be more demanding. You know, if I were chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, I would not have agreed to a B-21 program that was spread out over 30 or 35 years. I would have said, we have to do it in less time, and we'll fund it. Because that's one of the keys. If you don't fund it, you can't build them faster, and Congress will pay for it. So, you know, Congress has got a role they can play here, and they should.
All right. Chris Stewart, Jim Petrosky, thanks for joining us to discuss, you know, some of the problems we've seen in the modernization program. Well, I also want to thank you, the listeners, of course, because without you, NIDS View would not be here. So thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening. And of course, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.